This is Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Doug Hamilton, and thank you for joining us for our Main Street across North Dakota this time of day. And as you know, if you walk around any street in North Dakota, you are likely to see a lawn sign or a bumper sticker or hear an advertisement or read one in the newspaper or see it on television, because it is the election season here. The November midterm elections are looming large, and joining us from our Bismarck studio to talk about his role in all this hoopla is Kevin Kramer, the U.S. representative for the state of North Dakota. Thanks for joining us, Kevin.
Thanks for the opportunity, Doug, always.
Why do you want to trade your House seat for a place in the Senate?
Well, first of all, it's not my House seat. It's your House seat. And, it's a great way to put it, because in North Dakota, being an at-large House member is a little different than a lot of my colleagues who have many many colleagues from their own state. But it was really a matter of the opportunity for our state and the call of a lot of North Dakotans and as well as the president and others that made the case that one vote matters a lot in the United States Senate, with a one vote majority for Republicans, with a one vote majority on a one vote difference on many topics, from tax cuts to repeal and replacement of Obamacare and various regulatory rollbacks and judgeships and all of the really big things that the Senate takes up, that where there's a much closer margin. The case was made to Chris, my wife, that for the sake of our country, we ought to use the capital that I've built up in the last 6 years as North Dakota's only House member and put it on the line for North Dakota's U.S. Senate seat. So it's really North Dakota Senate seat, and I'm, ever since I said reluctantly said yes, I've been all in.
Well, the president has come to your support. He came here in June, had a big rally here. You spoke briefly. He's coming back for a fundraiser later this week. So why is he coming back?
Yeah, I think because, it's interesting. I just talked to the president last week. He called just to say hi. He actually called me from Indiana. He had just arrived in Indiana for the big rally there, and he called just to say hi and to encourage me. And he said, Kevin, you've been so supportive of me. You were supportive of me before just about any other member of Congress, and I'm reciprocating. I want to be supportive of you. But at the same time, I think what's really important to the president is back to this notion of one vote matters. He knows that if he's going to continue his agenda, particularly the appointment and confirmation of federal judges at the district level, the appellate level, and even the United States Supreme Court, that he's going to need to have a good functioning working majority in the United States Senate. So, for him to see his first term continue to be as successful as it's been, he needs more Republicans in the United States Senate. So there's something in it for all of us, and I appreciate his help.
At that June rally, you mentioned in your brief remarks that you supported the president 100%. And, of course, that number, that 100%, has been picked up as sort of a political statement. Was it an overstatement?
Well, not at all, because the statement wasn't that I support him 100%. What I did is I cited a number of policies, such as Tax Cuts and Jobs Act, repeal and replacement of Obamacare, support for repealing funding for sanctuary cities and supporting life, particularly repealing the availability of late-term abortions or pain-capable abortions. And I said, after citing those policies, I stated that on these policies, I stand 100% with you, with them, pointing to the people in North Dakota, and you, Mr. President, 100% of the time.
What significant policy disagreements do you have with President Trump?
Sure. There have been a few, but, my voting record with him isn't even 100%. But it's much higher with him than I suspect it was with Barack Obama. But it's really not the president that I measure. It's the policy itself. Where we have been in disagreement as of late, of course, is I've not supported his decision to use tariffs as the main tool in the trade dispute. However, since he's chosen them, I've stood with him, because I think we're a lot better off united against other countries than we are divided and undermining his authority, even though he's chosen a tool that I would have probably not chosen. I might not have been as successful as he's been in these trade deals. The other one on the trade front in particular regarding particularly NAFTA is this strong conviction he has that there ought to be a 5-year sunset on any NAFTA agreement. I just don't like that. And the reason I don't like it Doug, is because it doesn't have – I think 5 years isn't long enough. I think 5 years, it may be good for some things, but certainly not for large investment, particularly infrastructure investment. It presents too much uncertainty beyond 5 years. I mean, even think about things like gas and oil pipelines, for example, which are an infrastructure that we do share across both our northern and southern borders, particularly the northern border. And if you're going to ask a company to make a multi-billion-dollar investment, or if they need to make a multi-million-dollar investment, billion-dollar investment, even to move our product to market, they probably need to have more than 5 years to have it paid for. And so he and I have disagreed on that, and I've talked to him about that. But, sometimes I can make have some more influence in other things. And on that one, he feels pretty strongly about the five-year sunset.
Well, do you think North Dakota farmers will be the victims of this policy, at least as it's currently unfolding?
Well, I think with regard to the five-year deal, I think NAFTA, whether it has 5 year sunset or not, or it has a seven-year look back, I think it's sensible to have a look back provision in trade deals. I think it makes sense to have a look back provision in all kinds of things, including a lot of regulations that are passed, because we oftentimes don't look back to make sure that they're accomplishing what they were set out to accomplish. So I don't have a problem with that. Will farmers, North Dakota farmers, be victims of it? I think North Dakota farmers are going to be actually the victors with regard to NAFTA.
But I'm not really talking about NAFTA when I talk about the current issue, in which that's China and soybeans.
Well, China and soybeans is a little bit different, although they're all part of trade. NAFTA, European Union, obviously, China. China is a particularly unusual one in that China's been ripping farmers off for decades. They've subsidized wheat, corn, and rice to the tune of over $100 million over WTO allowances. They've also blocked out a lot of our products like oil, for example, soybean oil and things like that, based on made up provisions. So they've been hurting us for a long time. The problem is, in the short run right now with this dispute, particularly the tariffs on Chinese products, and particularly steel and aluminum, the Chinese have retaliated against, particularly, again, specifically our soybean farmers, some other products as well, but mainly soybean farmers. So yes, right now the value of the soybeans in North Dakota and other states throughout the country is lower than it was prior to this. It's slightly lower than it was a year ago. But this is also why the president has offered up this mitigation plan to help the farmers get through the short-term pain while...
And what's your feeling about the mitigation plan?
The mitigation plan was my idea, actually. I wrote to the Secretary of Agriculture back in late March when they first started talking about the 301 and implementing these tariffs in case there would be retaliation, realizing that retaliation very likely would be aimed at agriculture. And the reason for that is simply because agriculture is the one industry that has a rather large trade surplus. And so I'm concerned about that, and being quite familiar with the Commodity Credit Corporation, I wrote to Secretary Perdue and said, take a look at your authority under the CCC, as well as the revenue or the money that you have there, and see if there's not some sort of a plan just in case, still hoping that that wouldn't be necessary. And as it turns out, that's exactly what happened. I'd prefer trade to aid. I think most farmers would. In fact, every farmer I've ever talked to says they'd prefer trade to aid. But at the same time, for those farmers, and there are a lot of them, that support the idea of a better trade deal, both with China and Canada and Mexico, and as well as all of Europe, they understand and appreciate that there's at least an effort to provide some compensation, some sort of a safety net through the negotiating process. And the other thing about the mitigation plan, Doug, that I think is important is it sends a strong signal to these other countries that we're not going to simply allow our farmers to be retaliated against and be defenseless. And so, you'll always wish you could have more, or wish we didn't have to do it at all. But I think, round one at least is an effort in the right direction. I'd like to see some more things done.
Well, that proposed subsidy is $12 billion. Mm-hmm. But how long could something like that be sustained? I mean, how long could this debacle continue between China and the U.S.? Both leaders appear to be digging their heels in.
Well, they are a little bit, although you've seen again already this week, particularly since the European Union and Canada have now also put up some barriers to China's dumping of steel and aluminum because of the you know, the vastness of the situation and the fact that the president has gotten so many of these, so many countries involved. Once we stopped or put tariffs on the dumping of Chinese steel, then the Chinese started dumping that steel on our allies, and our allies aren't taking it any better than we did. And so now we're starting to isolate China a little bit, which is probably why you've seen China come back to the negotiating
table. Didn't we have China in a pretty good isolated position when we were talking about the Trans-Pacific Partnership, which the president threw out as soon as he came into office? I mean, what I'm getting at here, sure, is the president acting like a bull in a China shop.
Well, it appeared like that for a while to a lot of people, and yet here we're seeing his strategy actually playing out to the point where China is becoming isolated. You have to remember that not Canada, not a single country in the European Union had much incentive to negotiate with the United States or to ally with us versus China. And the reason for that is because we made so many large concessions to them after World War II that are still in place, including their ability to have 4 times the tariffs on our products as we can put on theirs. So it's not like any of them are going to give it up easily. Now we see that they are all coming to the negotiating table, including the European Union. Not long after they decried, you know, this president, they came right back to the United States and said, well, let's talk about non-tariff barriers and tariffs and maybe even eliminating subsidies. And so, they needed to have enough of an incentive, Doug, an economic incentive to come to the table. And they didn't have that if we were just going to, have nice talks. With regard to TPP, the president did throw it out, but the previous president didn't have enough votes in Congress to pass it. And one of the biggest reasons they didn't is because the TPP didn't adequately deal with currency manipulation, which we're seeing a lot of right now. I was a supporter of TPA, Trade Promotion Authority, and that was for President Obama. I think presidents have to have that authority. You can't have 535 of your closest friends in Congress being on the negotiating team or you'd never get anything done. I don't care how good they are. And so I supported TPA. I was not crazy about TPP, partly because it's over 7,000 pages long, and it's a hard thing to wrap your mind around in a short time. But you're right. The point of TPP was to utilize all of our allies and go head-to-head with China in the Asia-Pacific. The president's doing that now with bilateral deals, including South Korea, including Japan and Indonesia. And so we'll see how that all turns out.
Representative Kevin Cramer is a Republican. He's running for the seat currently held by Democrat Senator Heidi Heitkamp. And Kevin, for most of the 12 minutes now, we've been talking about the issue of trade. You've mm-hmm. touched on health care and the tax cut, abortion, and the sanctuary city issue. And it strikes me that these are national issues. So is this election about you and other members of the House, in their individual districts, yours being an entire state, mm-hmm. or is it a referendum on President Trump this upcoming election?
It's really more of for North Dakotans, it's always about North Dakota. And we have the great advantage, Doug, of having a small state, or as I like to say, a small state, but a large congressional district, because we have the same population as a congressional district. But and we have the advantage of having a pretty intimate relationship between our public officials and the voters of North Dakota. And that's a blessing that I think all of us in public life enjoy in our state. So I think it's always about North Dakota. And so the issues that I've talked about, you call them national issues, and yet they're also very local issues. I mean, the issue of the escalating, and I mean skyrocketing premiums in the Affordable Care Act, so-called Affordable Care Act, is a problem for North Dakotans, for farmers. Farmers in a recent survey done by USDA said that the cost of health care is their number one concern. And so, this is, yes, it's a national issue, but it's a very, very much a North Dakota issue. We have roughly the same percentage of uninsured today in North Dakota as we had previous to Obamacare passing. The problem now is that the people who are uninsured in our state are small business owners, farmers, ranchers, young, healthy men and women for whom there's less incentive to have insurance than there is to not have it. So they've chosen to not have insurance. They're not in the risk pool. Should they get sick, they simply buy the insurance at the time that they get sick and pay a penalty if they need to, but it's far less than the high cost insurance in the exchanges.
Well, about a year ago, you were holding town halls and you were getting pushback from constituents mm-hmm. about what was happening with health care in Congress, the many attempts to repeal Obamacare mm-hmm. and the lack of something to replace it with. We are talking about health insurance, which relies almost
exclusively on the size of the pool, mm-hmm. on the number of people who are paying premiums.
That's right.
So hasn't all of the things that have been happening in Congress and what the president's been trying to do been diminishing the size of that pool?
Not that I know of. I mean, supposedly Obamacare was going to bring a lot more people into the pool with health care. And what it did is it created a perverse incentive for people to not buy health insurance.
I seem to remember seeing that there were more people insured in North Dakota under Obamacare and the extension of Medicare or Medicaid, than there had been before.
Now, it's about the same right now. It's always been rough, somewhere between 8 and 10%. Right now, it's 8.1% people uninsured in North Dakota. That's roughly what it was before Obamacare. It fluctuates up and down a little bit. And it's easy to see why. Because when you have a product that you have to buy, whether you want it or not, and it has no flexibility in it, and you're a young, healthy person with, you know, and you know you can buy it should you get sick, you've created an incentive for young, healthy people, the very people we want in the pool, by
yes.
the way,
yeah.
to not be in the pool. And partly because the cost, the socialized costs go up so much for those young, healthy people. So what we've done is we've replaced one group of people with another group of people. And by the way, North Dakota has always taken care of people with pre-existing conditions. That was a state program before we had Obamacare. Same with Minnesota. They had a very successful risk pool for people that were otherwise uncovered. So this is, in my mind, it's always been a state-by-state issue and should have remained a state-by-state issue. And that's why the replacement that Republicans put up in the American Health Care Act that was passed in the House and failed in the Senate by a vote, and frankly, the bill that the Senate Republicans put up, Graham Cassidy, was even better than the House bill, and that failed by one vote. And that is that it would have given much more flexibility to states. It also would have provided, in the case of North Dakota, more money to states, but at the same time met those fundamental principles of covering people with pre-existing conditions, not discriminating, and to the degree that there's any price discrimination, that price discrimination could be made up by either by the states or the federal government through various means such as risk pools and state stabilization funds. And there are all kinds of mechanisms put in place to meet the basic principles of coverage for everybody without distorting the market so severely and driving people out of the market, which is what Obamacare did in many parts of the country. There are something like 40% of the counties in this country that have one or fewer choices for health insurance.
Well, it doesn't matter where you get your health insurance. The price of it, the cost of it,
yes.
is intimidating, to say the least.
It is. And the other thing is access, Doug. But you're right. The cost of it is intimidating. This is, and I'd lay this on a lot of Republicans as well, previous to President Obama becoming President Obama. The accessibility and cost of health care was an issue that Republicans didn't deal with when they had majorities in the House and the Senate and the presidency before. And their lack of not dealing with it was in no small part the reason that Barack Obama was able to become president of the United States, and certainly a reason why he was able to pass Obamacare. So, there's plenty, throughout history, missed opportunities to fix the system.
Let's talk about this campaign kind of specifically here. The
sure.
role of newspapers and broadcasters in elections has diminished a bit with the rise of social media in particular.
Sure.
Have your campaign tactics changed with the times?
Yeah, that's a great question, actually, Doug. They probably change in the sense that there's more of it, but the same old stuff is still the same old stuff. In other words, there's still a lot of television buying, a lot of radio buying. We have newspaper ads up this week as we talk. I don't have as much money as Senator Heitkamp does, but neither one of us has as much money as the outside groups have, and they're doing a lot of the same things. So all of that's still, I'd say, pretty much the same. But you're right. What has changed is social media and digital advertising and communication. And so that has brought a whole new – really a new medium to the table, not so much a switched medium, although I think you are starting to see the shift take place even in North Dakota, further away from broadcast and more into the social side of things. The other thing, though, the neat thing I think about being running for office in North Dakota, particularly a high office like this, and this is why I think you see such a national attention here, not just because there's just one vote difference and one vote matters, and it is a U.S. Senate seat in a relatively inexpensive state to run in. is that it's very granular. This is a non-presidential year. There'll probably be no doubt, in fact, I'd say fewer than 300,000 people voting in this election. And so there's a lot more of the, you know, the voter ID, you know, granular research and data collection and getting to know just what every person thinks and getting to know them on a, as personal a level as possible. And I think it makes it, you know, more special, frankly, for every voter, because every voter is well understood and is in high value.
And, of course, if they're in play.
that's exactly right. If they're in play, the persuadables, as I call them.
So let's get a sense. How many persuadables do you think there are out there?
Yeah, you know what? It's so funny. You're quite astute, Doug. I know you already knew that. But when I go out on the stump and I talk to people, particularly when I talk to people that aren't from North Dakota, so your colleagues in the national media especially, when I start talking about the fact that there probably be 280,000 to 300,000 voters at the most in this election, that first of all blows them away. You know, that a Senate seat is going to be determined by that few people. Then when you consider that Senator Heitkamp and I were both elected on the very same day by the very same people in 2012, we've been serving the very same Congresses, voting on a lot of the same bills, we both have, you know, virtually universal name recognition, and not just name recognition, but people have strong opinions about us. They know us really well. It's one of the blessings of serving here. And so that narrows the base of persuadables quite a bit. I'm going to just go out on a limb and answer your question directly and say I suspect there are something like 40 to 50,000 people that are persuadable in this election. Now, that's not to say not everybody's persuadable at some level, but by and large, the vast majority of voters probably already know who they're going to vote for.
Okay. Well, earlier this month, the Koch brothers, who have traditionally donated to Republican campaigns, announced that they would not endorse your run against Heitkamp. What's your take on that?
Well, it's interesting. You know, I like the Koch company. I mean, they do a lot of good things, and they're a legacy North Dakota company. They were doing oil work, particularly pipeline work in North Dakota long before the Bakken. But there are some other things that I don't like so much that they do. They're libertarian. They're not Republicans. They're not Democrats. They're libertarians, the Kochs themselves. They don't like farm bills. They came to my office, a couple of months ago. I say they, a couple of their policy people came to meet with my policy people and asked them to persuade me to oppose the farm bill. Well, for crying out loud, I wrote a good chunk of the farm bill on the House side, the commodity title and some things in the conservation title as well and crop insurance. And so obviously I'm not going to oppose a farm bill, particularly one that I think is pretty darn good. They also, you know, they'd like me to, I think, be more of an opponent to President Trump. I think I'm a little bit of a weapon in their war with President Trump. But I don't begrudge them. It's their money. It's their endorsement. It's not mine. I'm not entitled to it. I've never met either one of the Koch brothers, so I don't know them on a personal
level. But they are pointing to a split in the Republican Party that does exist.
A little bit, but it's been to my benefit, I can tell you that. I've had many people around the country, Republicans, that were sort of stunned by the whole notion and questioned the wisdom of the Koch brothers' decision. And maybe they'll come around. I don't know, but I know this much. I don't get up in the morning and think, gee, what can I do today to help the Koch brothers like me more? But I do get up and say, hey, what can I do today to help North Dakota? And sometimes those two things aren't the same, and that's okay.
Kevin Kramer is the U.S. representative for North Dakota. He is a candidate for U.S. Senate, and of course, November is looming large. Thank you for joining us today, Representative Kramer.
It's always my pleasure, Doug. Thanks for the opportunity.
Coming up, the news with Danielle, but after that, another candidate, Al Jaeger, will seek another term as Secretary of State.
For Prairie Public, I'm Danielle Webster. A new survey of supply managers in the Mid-America region of the U.S. shows North Dakota with a strong showing for the month of August. The Mid-America Economic Index looks at conditions in a 9-state region, which includes North Dakota. Creighton University economist Ernie Goss conducts the survey. Any survey reading over 50 points toward economic growth, and according to the August numbers, North Dakota saw an index reading shoot from 69.6 in July to 76 in August, the highest in the region.
So this is very consistent job growth, even with the tight supply of labor. We're seeing an expansion tied to manufacturing, which is very good. This is not what many economists, including me, expected.
Goss says another unexpected is the wave of support for President Trump's trade tariffs.
4 out of 5 of the supply managers support either continuing the tariffs or keeps expanding them until the other side blinks. Now, we economists, we hope they blink. We hope there's some capitulation or at least getting some agreements here, particularly with Canada. And also the president's threatened to expand the tariffs with China this week or next week. So that's a real concern.
Goss says it will be interesting to watch North Dakota's numbers in September. He says the ongoing discussions with the Farm Bill and the end of the federal fiscal year could play a role in confidence among supply managers in the next survey. As more students head back to school this week, health officials are hoping parents will educate themselves on the dangers of electronic cigarettes or e-cigs. Melissa Markigard is tobacco coordinator with Fargo Cass Public Health. She says many e-cigarettes contain nicotine and they are illegal for anyone under the age of 18 to purchase and use. But many don't even look suspicious. One e-cig, called a Juul, resembles a flash drive.
They don't look like an e-cigarette, which is why we want to educate parents. We really want to be pushing them to be paying attention to what their kids have in their backpacks, what their kids have in their pocket, because that is they do not look like anything other than something that can just a USB, an inhaler. You know, they're very well hidden. They're being created and manufactured to really be not visible.
Markigard says parents should parents find anything like this among their children's belongings, they are encouraged to confiscate them and dispose of them right away. She says because nicotine can negatively impact brain development, it's important to make sure kids stay away from these devices. She says while tobacco use among youth is down, e-cigarette use is up. And in the early morning hours of August 28th of 2005, someone broke into the Judy Garland Museum in Grand Rapids, Minnesota, and stole a pair of ruby slippers worn by Garland in The Wizard of Oz. The thief left nothing but a trail of glass, and for 13 years, the slippers remained missing without a trace. Until now, that is, the FBI says the slippers have finally been recovered. FBI Special Agent Jill Sanborn, North Dakota U.S. Attorney Chris Myers, and Grand Rapids Police Chief Scott Johnson are hosting a press conference this afternoon in Minneapolis to make the formal announcement. Slippers are one of four surviving pairs worn by Garland in The Wizard of Oz. They had been on loan to the museum by a California collector. On the 10-year anniversary of their disappearance, a fan posted a $1 million reward for their return, but it expired without anyone stepping forward. The press conference was this afternoon in the FBI's Minneapolis building. For Prairie Public, I'm Danielle Webster.
This is Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Doug Hamilton, joined by Al Jaeger, the independent candidate for North Dakota Secretary of State, and he joins us from our studio in Bismarck. Thanks for being with us.
Well, good afternoon, Doug. It's always good to be with you.
And why are you running for another four-year term? You've been at this for quite a while.
Well, this is my 26th year, and the voters of North Dakota have been very kind to me, and I'm very grateful for that. We have so many things happening in the office now, and I knew this going back to the last 12 months, and I really want to see them forward, see them through. It's really an exciting time in my office with technology, with our nd.gov website. There's things that we're doing with elections. Just all kinds of things, and I just felt that it was important to have the continuity to carry us through this particular time and, make sure that the transition into an entire new way of doing work in our office, our technology project that'll provide online services is just a matter of weeks away from being deployed, and we've been working on that for over 3 years now. Everything is going very, very well, and that we call it First Stop, and that'll become one of the cornerstones of another thing that we've been working on and state agencies have been working on for quite a while. Right now it's been called North Dakota Business Gateway. They have a project fellow assigned from the Department of Commerce where our database and the information that we will have will provide a single entry for businesses in terms of their interaction with several other agencies. And so we had our first meeting on that last Thursday. And so every day something new is happening. It's really, really fun right now.
Well, if you succeed, would this be your last term in office?
Yes, it will be.
Because you're second only to Ben Meyer for sticking to it at the Secretary of State's office. He ran the office for 33 years.
Right, yeah. He had 34 years in, and so I'm not going to make that, and I don't want to make it. But, you know, at this particular time, I knew over a year ago that, you know, there's so many things. Again, with our technology project, we have a excellent team in place. I have excellent staff this morning. There was 8, 9 of them together in a room working through. They're just doing testing right now of the system to make sure that everything is okay. And it's just fun to watch them interact and to make sure that what we have will be very user-friendly. And one of the things, too, that we want to see through on is the state really needs a new voting system. When the Help America Vote Act was passed in 2002, everybody in the country bought new voting equipment at that time. And, you know, that equipment, you know, it's just not technology now has come so far. And the systems are so much better. And so we want to make sure that we're preparing now to go to the legislature and request funding for that. And so that's, you know, really going well. And, you know, speaking of elections, we can really assure the voters of North Dakota that all of the talk that we hear about hacking and all of that, the state cybersecurity is really up to snuff. In 2016, we found out quite a bit after the fact that North Dakota, somebody had attempted to get into our systems, and we're under the umbrella of the Information Technology Department, and they have an excellent security system. So we are very good on that, and then our scanners are not connected with each other, so they can't be hacked. And so people can be assured that going into the election, everything is going to be good, and their vote will be counted accurately, and the results will be accurate. And so, great. It's a fun time right now.
Well, when you first ran for Secretary of State in 1992, you were a Republican. When you last ran in 2014, you ran as a Republican. You're running as an independent this time. Explain to our listeners. Remind them why.
Well, essentially, I'm still running as a Republican, even though I'm running as an independent. I have the full support of the Republican Party, and Republicans from throughout the state have been so supportive and so kind and so encouraging. So yes, I'm going to be on the ballot as an independent, but in reality, I still am a Republican. Nothing changed, and so essentially. I'm running as an independent because things changed after the state convention, and the individual that was endorsed at the convention withdrew. And so I stepped in because I wanted to, and there was a need. And so the only way at that time, because of the timing, the only way that I could run is as an independent. The state law, I suspect, is going to be tweaked in this next session to accommodate any political party that has a situation like what happened this last year so that they could actually fill that position. But that option wasn't available, and so I'm running as an independent. But I think, you know, in reality, people will still know that I'm a Republican.
It had to be a little disappointing, though, after putting in more than 20 years as the Republican who was running the Secretary of State's office in North Dakota, not to be endorsed for reelection.
Well, it's one of those things. You know, I've gone to many political conventions over the years, and they all take on a different type of atmosphere, and this is one that happened. And I felt that I had a good, strong record to represent, you know, to represent the party. And it's just one of those things that happened. And I don't have any problem with that. But circumstances were such that I now am running again and looking forward to it. We have so many things going forward, things that we've done, things that we're building on. And I really feel that for the state of North Dakota and for the citizens, it's really important that we continue that continuity into another term.
Is the GOP backing you financially then?
Well, yes, they really have. I mean, they've given me the letter of support, and individually, Republicans from throughout the state are supporting me. Other people too. I do have Democrat friends that vote for me and support me. And so It's really I've tried to over the years run our office in a nonpartisan manner, realizing that of course we get elected through a partisan process, but once you're on the job, you treat everybody the same, and I treat Republicans the same as I do Democrats, and we treat everybody in the same way, and so that's just the way I operate our office.
Does the North Dakota Republican Party have the same apparent division that the National Party has, the sort of the Trump's supporters and the mainline Republicans from generations past? Is that reflected in the state party as well?
Well, I don't think so. I think everybody is pretty united in terms of, you know, the Republicans in North Dakota as far as, you know, the state voted substantially in favor of Trump, and the Republican policies and goals and what have you, I think, are really most of the Republicans in the state, I believe, are in the same wavelength on those. He's made decisions that certainly are favorable to our North Dakota citizenship in terms of certain things that he has rolled back. And I really don't get into the federal part in terms of a candidate. My concentration is on the state and what we need to do here in the state. And that's my goal every day, to how can we do the best for the citizens of North Dakota.
Well, one thing you do is look at initiated measures that are proposed, that are petitioned, and validate them for the ballot. So let's talk about some of these. Measure number one. This initiated measure to add an ethics commission to the state constitution. Are you a supporter of that?
No, I'm not. It's not that I'm against the ethics commission, but having been Secretary of State for as long as I have, and there's been efforts made on different topics before. When you get this type of detail into the constitution, I'm very concerned about that because when things don't work out, the only way that you can change it is, again, by the vote of the people. And I'm very concerned about that. So I'm not against the concept. I'm against the fact that it's being voted on and it's going to be placed in the Constitution. And I think if it that's why I'm opposed to it. It's just it's not a good, sound way of meeting an end goal because there's too many questions. And again, when it's in the Constitution, a recent example, Marcy's Law. Overall, I think it's working well, but there are things that have come up. And again, the only way that it can be corrected is through a vote of the people. And I think it would be better if this had gone through the regular statutory provisions and passed in that way, promoted in that way. Because then if something doesn't work quite right, needs fine-tuning, then the legislature can take care of it.
Well, the initiated measure happened because the legislature has been dealing with this issue for a long time now. They've basically sort of been kicking it down the road. And so now there's an initiated measure. Would you be okay if the initiated measure was for an ethics commission that would be statutorily adapted?
Well, yes, I would. And also I think there's a lot of things that have been talked about in the past years. You have to you know, there have been bills introduced over the years, but they've been they haven't been introduced with the idea of working across the aisle. They have not been. Again, I've been through 13 sessions, and I've seen how these bills are put together. And so, I think it's a misnomer to say that there's things that have been tried before and defeated. Because they just weren't well written, and they were partisan in nature, and that's not the way to achieve what really is needed in terms of the well-balanced approach to ethics and control. A lot of the things that are being proposed in Measure 1 are already in state law, and so you know there's a. And it's going to override some things, and that's a concern.
Measure number two clarifies that only U.S. citizens and North Dakota residents can vote in federal, state, local, or school elections. Why is that necessary?
Well, I think that what the promoters were looking at there is that, for instance, in California, there's efforts being made to allow non-citizens to vote in local elections like school elections and what have you. And this particular measure, as we read it, basically says that it's U.S. citizens that can vote in all elections, and to make that clear that there can't be an we cannot have a pick and choose where non-citizens can vote in elections, and I think that's a response to what's happened in other states, like I said, in California, where there's an effort being made in some cities to allow non-citizens to vote in elections. Where, I would have to say that I would be concerned about that too.
Does this mean I have to bring a passport to a voting booth? What does it mean to prove that I'm a U.S. citizen?
Well, basically, what we have now in terms of identification and all of that, and there isn't anything specific under current law that says that you or I or anybody has to bring anything here in North Dakota, but it certainly makes it clear. And then, so if there are non-citizens that end up voting, they are would be subject to prosecution.
Well, let's move on to measure number three. That's been getting a lot of ink and airtime, the initiated measure to legalize recreational marijuana.
Well, that's another one where I think it was described on Friday, as I recall listening to your program by the media people that you had on, that the devil is in the details. And this is another one of those examples, both measure one and measure three. For instance, one of the things in Measure 3 is that towards the end, and these measures can be read in full on the Secretary of State's website, there's a statement that says something to the effect that no one can be prosecuted for growing marijuana, cultivating marijuana, et cetera, which basically that negates a lot of laws in terms of zoning or whatever. So you could conceivably have a neighbor that's growing marijuana, and you couldn't do anything about it because the law says it can't be prosecuted. And so there's a lot of concerns, again, with the details in that. So that's one that I think law enforcement, a lot of people have a lot of concerns about. I talked to somebody in the oil industry. They're very concerned because they don't want to have drivers and other people out there in the oil fields that might be high. And again, the details of that, expunging their record if you've been arrested in the past, essentially it would be free reign. You could do whatever you want.
Measure number four requires free access to state parks and personalized license plates for volunteer emergency responders. Do we need a measure for that?
Well, essentially, this is one of the things with the whole initiated process. This was a very grassroots effort by some people that felt strongly about it, they felt that they've tried something in past sessions, probably didn't promote it quite correctly, and they felt that this is something they wanted to do. And so it's a choice. It's something that was this was very grassroots. There's no out-of-state money. There's no extra group coming in like in Measure 1 that it's all being funded from out-of-state interests, and so this is very grassroots, and so it's up to the people to decide whether they think this is a good idea.
How many people typically vote in a midterm election in North Dakota?
Not as many as should. One of the things that philosophically from the standpoint of my office, it's not my job to get out the vote. It's my job to educate the public in terms of their voting, their options, where to vote, and all of that. It is really the people who support candidates and measures and what have you to promote voter turnout. Unfortunately, in the midterm election, our voter turnout is kind of in the 40s, where in a presidential year we're over 60%. And so every election is important. The June election, we don't have the turnout there, and yet the June election has the items on the ballot of schools and city elections and what have you. That's government closest to the people, and there should be more participation in the voting process. But that's one of the decisions that that we can make in a state like or in a country like ours. We can choose to vote or choose not to vote, and hopefully the people that do choose to vote are informed about the issues and make choices accordingly.
Well, if you don't vote, the person who votes is twice as important as you are. Do you expect turnout to be significantly different this year or similar?
That's difficult to predict. I would think that there are several things that could drive voter turnout. First of all, the measures will. I would suspect that Measure 3 will either attract people that are definitely for it or people that are definitely against it. And, of course, we can't overlook the U.S. Senate race when the nation is looking on that particular race. So I would suspect that, that particular race is going to drive turnout, too.
Well, of the people who typically vote in a North Dakota midterm election, what's the typical party breakdown?
That I can't, really give you a number because, we don't have a way of quantifying that because when you come to vote, you aren't identifying yourself as a Republican or a Democrat or Libertarian or whatever party you're affiliated with. So, I think media sometimes can make generalizations as to who turned out and whose supporters were there. But there isn't anything specifically, I think, that can quantify it other than, we do know on a statewide basis the Republicans certainly have, control of both chambers. They have all of the statewide offices. And so I suppose, can be said that the people who are Republicans and support the Republican Party or support candidates that are associated with the Republican Party are certainly have been in the majority.
Well, the one statewide office they don't have is the one that Heidi Heitkamp has. That's probably going to draw a lot of people to the polls, as you mentioned. What advice do you have for people who've complained in the past about difficulties casting a ballot? I'm talking about college students, for example, or Native Americans.
Well, there's a lot of things that are misinformation on that. First of all, everybody wants every qualified North Dakota person to be able to vote. And so, you have to be a U.S. citizen, 18 years of age, and have lived in North Dakota for at least, 30 days. And so really what we have set up in North Dakota is relatively easy. All you really need to is bring your North Dakota identification. Most people that vote, close to 96-97% have the proper identification.
Is my dorm address okay then if I'm a college student?
Well, you need to have your identification to match up with that. And, what we find particularly in the presidential years is that college students, they're eligible to vote from where they come from. They can vote absentee, but all of a sudden they want to come and vote.
Well, they're living for 4 years in Fargo or Grand Forks or Mayville.
Unless they make a change with their address and what have you and actually become a North Dakota resident, there's no attempt made to we want everybody to be able to vote. We just want to be able to have all North Dakota eligible people to be able to vote. And so,
well, Al Jaeger, independent candidate for North Dakota Secretary of State, endorsed by the Republican Party. Big election coming up. Thank you for spending some time with our listeners.
You're welcome, Doug.
Dakota Datebook is next.
For Prairie Public is provided by the Bush Foundation, investing in great ideas and the people who power them in Minnesota, North Dakota, and South Dakota. Learn more at bushfoundation.org. And by Great River Energy, powering what's possible by using new technologies to operate some of the most efficient power plants in North Dakota, helping to meet the energy needs of member consumers through reliable and affordable electricity and sound environmental stewardship.
This is Dakota Datebook for September 4th. Grasshoppers turned up in the Dakotas long before the misery of the Great Depression. On this date in 1919, Professor Waldron, of the North Dakota Agricultural College noted that the insects were moving out of the fields following the harvest. They were congregating at the edges of the roads where they could still find some greenery. It meant that they would be laying eggs along the roadsides across the state. Professor Waldron urged farmers to rake the soil to the middle of the roads. An ordinary road grader could be used for the task. Grasshopper eggs in the middle of the road would be crushed under the wheels of wagons and farm equipment. Destroying the eggs was the best way to avoid a future plague. 1919 was not the last time grasshoppers were a problem in North Dakota, and it was not the worst. The decade of the 1930s is known for the Great Depression, and there was plenty of misery to go around. North Dakotans also associate the 1930s with dust, drought, and grasshoppers. The insects filled the skies. There are stories of clouds of grasshoppers that blocked out the sun. Entomologists say this is believable. Some species of grasshoppers have been found flying as high as 9,000 feet. In their enormous numbers, they could indeed darken the sun. They crunched underfoot and ate anything that didn't move. They wiped out acres of crops. They ate paint off buildings and varnish off the handles of farm tools. Some farmers considered themselves lucky to harvest a mere 2 bushels of wheat per acre. Favorable weather conditions supported the grasshopper outbreak. Populations of several types had grown slowly from 1928 to 1930. Then their numbers exploded in 1931 and 32. They devastated fields of alfalfa, corn, wheat, and even the shelter belt trees. Ironically, the grasshoppers were finally brought under control by the drought. It was even too dry for them. The insects that plagued the Great Plains have been immortalized in literature. In her books about growing up on the plains, Laura Ingalls Wilder remembered a glittering cloud of insects that devastated her father's crops. In his 1924 book, Giants in the Earth, writer O. E. Rolvaag described ominous clouds of raging little demons. To those trying to survive in North Dakota, grasshoppers seem to be a biblical plague right out of the Old Testament. Today's Dakota Datebook is written by Carol Butcher. I'm Errol Pepcorn.
Dakota Datebook is produced in cooperation with the State Historical Society of North Dakota, with funding from the North Dakota Humanities Council.
We'd like to thank the North Dakota Council on the Arts for supporting arts programming, along with our members and other sources, here on Prairie Public.
Wednesday on Main Street, it was Years in the Making, a Prairie Public original documentary titled The Rise and Fall of the Nonpartisan League, will debut next Monday. And joining us tomorrow to talk about her final project before retirement will be producer Kim Stenjen. And we'll also hear about the Nurturing Parenting Program, a project of the Department of Human Services and NDSU Extension. We hope you can join us for Main Street on Wednesday. In the meantime, enjoy the rest of your day.